Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College online journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Hello and welcome to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast. I'm Andrew Hill, and today I'm joined by Richard Lackument. He is the Dean of the School of Strategic Land Power here at the United States Army War College. Richard, welcome.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So, Richard, you served as a colonel in the United States Army prior to your retirement. You are a graduate of the United States Military Academy, class of 1984. You served in the 82nd Airborne Division, the 1st Armored Division, the 101st Airborne Division, and the 3rd Infantry Division. And you graduated from Princeton University from the Wilson School with a Master's in Public Affairs in 1995. And served for many years as an Army strategist. You have also been here at the War College since 2009, with the exception of 12 months in Afghanistan. And you've been here since I've been here, certainly. So we've had many great talks over the years. Today, we're talking about something that's a little sobering. So you recently participated in an event that was held not exactly in commemoration of, but sort of to remember the lessons of the My Lai massacre, which occurred on March 16th, 1968. And Richard, can you tell us a little bit about that event?
Sure. So, yes, as you said, the Judge Advocate General of the Army and people working for him had identified that as coming up, and they chose to put together a symposium, and it was hosted at the Pentagon by the Judge Advocate General Corps. And Lieutenant General Petey, the head of the Judge Advocate General Corps, the Judge Advocate General, was the host. But General Milley opened up the event to give some remarks. And then there were two panel discussions, one a bit about the history of the event, as well as the prosecutions and the investigation prosecutions that followed. And then the panel that I was on with Dr. Louis Sorley and Major General retired Robert Scales, to talk a little bit about how the Army had dealt with My Lai since 1968, to look at how the Army had evolved, particularly in my case, focused on the Army profession and what we had done to learn and respond and try to mitigate events like that happening in the future.
So walk me through the massacre in its broad details.
Okay. Yeah, so on March 16th, 1968, which is about 6 weeks after the beginning of the Tet Offensive, and so although during the Vietnam War, and so although the main offensive had sort of subsided and the United States and the South Vietnamese and other allies had sort of gained control again, there were still a lot of battles going around South Vietnam. Now, this particular unit hadn't been in much combat when it went into the area around My Lai, but this was purported to be an area very sympathetic to the Viet Cong, the communist guerrillas who were part of the enemy forces working with the North Vietnamese, fighting against the United States, Republic of Vietnam, and their allies.
And this was an Army infantry unit.
And this was an Army infantry unit that went in, part of the 25th Infantry Division, that went into the area on the morning of the 16th of March. And although early on they did encounter an explosive device, a booby trap or mine that went off and killed one officer and wounded some others, there's very little evidence of any other fire. There were some other traps, but there were almost no military-age men found in the villages. And in the official reports, 128 people were killed. Now, it came out later that at least 300 and maybe as high as 500 people died, Vietnamese died that day. Most were women, children, and elderly men. Like I said, almost no combat-age males at all. And only three weapons were found. So even the official report said there were three weapons found with 128 official reported dead. And the official reported potential sort of non-combatant killed was about 20. That from the brigade commander a few weeks later. So there's the initial event whereby the investigation went in and sort of dug through it, almost no enemy action, but an incredible number of kills. So the idea that there was a massacre of civilians perpetrated by American soldiers, overwhelmingly infantry soldiers, part of the 25th Infantry Division that occurred. And there were some interventions by soldiers, in particular a helicopter pilot named Hugh Thompson, who landed to put his helicopter between American soldiers and civilians trying to get away. and try to stop the massacre. There were others who resisted being part of the massacre. So there's plenty of evidence to show that, yes, the soldiers did kill the number of civilians. Again, low end 300, upper end around 500, and that there was little combat involved in that. So that's the incident itself.
So it's unambiguously a war crime.
Correct. I'd say I think that's a fair characterization, that it is a war crime. It was recognized. Eventually, prosecutions did occur. Now, what happened was, there are reports fairly early on. Hugh Thompson, the pilot I mentioned, does go to the chain of command and say and tell them what happened. And there were some others, and without knowing, being able to recite all the names, who did mention to their chain of command they thought there were problems. In fact, some of the initial possible charges that one of the investigations included were against chaplains who didn't report things that they had been told by soldiers. Other words, they didn't report what would pass on. Even if they weren't there, they didn't pass on the reports of the people who came to them about potential war crimes. So essentially, there's a fairly significant cover-up, and it's hard to sugarcoat that one, by the chain of command. Like I said, the official report was 128 dead with maybe 20 non-combatants that they admitted to. But the reports and how they were dealt with, Hugh Thompson's report was suppressed, as were many others. So nothing went really beyond, as far as we can tell, beyond the division. So that was covered up. It was about a year later that a soldier who was not part of one of the units that was it part of the massacres that day, nonetheless had heard about it. I believe, if I understood right, had flown over the battlefield that day and was aware of that there had been something going on that day. And he actually, when he finally got out of the Army and returned to the United States about a year later, in fact, he sent a letter to several military leaders and members of Congress in March 1969. So a year after the actual massacres, he sends those out.
And at this point, the American public has never heard of My Lai.
They have not.
Okay.
So initially those reports do lead to an investigation by the Army. The Army does look into it, does find enough evidence to bring charges against Lieutenant Calley, one of the platoon leaders that day. And so that happens in the first charge against him about September 1969. But about this time also, there's a very famous journalist by the name of Seymour Hersh who sort of picks up the story. And again, this probably now is creeping into the public domain because of the prosecutions, the court-martials, although this is all still inside Army channels. And so he publicizes it. And at about the same time, in terms of seeing exact cause and effect, about the time it goes public into the press, meaning with the Seymour Hersh articles, the Army decides to do a more thorough investigation and gives Lieutenant General William Pierce the responsibility. And with about 90 investigators, he does an incredibly thorough job. And this is posted on the internet. You can see the entire investigation. And as I recall, I believe that was available fairly quickly after the investigation was complete, which was in the early 1970. More charges were brought after that. Ultimately, he had and his team had put together charges of different varieties, not just murder, but also dereliction of duty, like with the chaplains who didn't report, for example, and sort of offered those up as 32 who the evidence suggested charges could be brought. Ultimately, charges recommended against most were dismissed by other general officers who were the court-martial convening authorities, and only six court-martials actually occurred. And five led to acquittals. The only conviction was Lieutenant William Calley, and his sentence was commuted from I forget the exact number, many years to just a few, and a lot of it was served on house arrest because of the intervention of President Nixon himself.
So the president commutes Calley's sentence?
Yes, in that portion, in terms of how he served it, meaning the house arrest portion.
So when I'm listening to this, a couple of questions arise. One is that there's this ongoing tension between the sort of civilian establishment and the military, and we've seen it in recent years, actually, with the sexual assault and harassment issues that many powerful stakeholders, Senator Gillibrand, for example, from New York, have lost their trust in the military to sort of police and govern itself legally. My Lai, when you talk about My Lai and the lessons of My Lai from the standpoint of risks to the profession, it is striking that you see such poor performance from people who you might think, the general officers, for example, who are involved, who you think might be, despite all of the issues with a Vietnam-era conscript force and all those other things, might be better safeguards of the profession. You know, so how do you view their their behavior.
Well, actually, in some regard, I think as a statement of the institution's professionalism, it's a fairly damning one at the time. And in fact, there's a study that General Westmoreland induces in 1970. I want to say about the same time the Peers Commission comes out. He asked the Army War College to conduct a study on the military profession. And they do it in about 2 months, and they come back with a fairly damning assessment of the quality of our espoused ideal values, duty on our country, mm-hmm. and sort of the values, practical values, or values in practice, what they really did, the actual behavior. And what they found, instead of adherence to these sort of higher values, more of a individualized career, ambition, protecting behaviors, ticket punching, zero defects, reporting to be successful by whatever measure, meaning falsifying statistics. And that included things like body counts in combat zones, routine training statistics, doctoring, AWOL statistics, things that might make them look bad. And so a sense that officers in many regard levels, and it was, how high up it went, the sense that, a lot of officers were seen to tolerate this as long as it made them look good. So the idea that this was sort of had infected the officer corps in a fairly profound way. And that broader sense of what's going on. I mean, the years that I mentioned, 68 is when the My Lai massacre occurs. A lot of this is resolved by early 1971, I think, was when the Cali case mm-hmm. finally is closed. But the issue there is we're still in the middle of the Vietnam War, and this is a very tense issue. So the moral calculations of, yes, it's one thing to have crimes committed. Atrocities have happened, in other words, maybe not this big, and I can't think of any other this large in U.S. history, certainly in the last 100 years, that, with the evidence, there's other smaller ones that usually they're handled as criminal activity.
There's one in Korea, right?
Often is brought up, and that's actually a fairly contested one in the sense of, that's more of
a little more
civilians
ambiguous.
In the crossfire.
Okay.
They're caught between enemy lines near the Pusan perimeter, as opposed to this is pretty unambiguous
of
the actual murder. And that's the word used, and that's what Cali's convicted of, the murder of unarmed women and children, and basically non-combatants. So there are other atrocities, but it's one thing to treat them as crimes. It's another thing to how does the institution respond?
Mm-hmm.
So a big difference, and I think this goes to the Senator Gillibrand, it's one thing to say, are there individual cases where people are accused of things where they're prosecuted? Yes. How well does the institution do percentage-wise prosecuting? Those tend to get at, are you likely to face prosecution for certain types of behaviors? And again, big difference between war crimes and some of the crimes we're talking about that has to do with sexual assault and harassment. Nonetheless, of the same ideas, like how does the institution respond?
Yeah, and that instinctive self-preservation mm-hmm. of the institution, I imagine, is much more pronounced when it's going through some broader difficulties. Mm-hmm. So My Lai occurs at a time when the Army as an institution is really trying to convey more of a sense of confidence and capability. Sort of similar to the French army in the late 19th century with the mm-hmm. Dreyfus affair, where, post Franco-Prussian War disaster and, there's an early recognition that Dreyfus has been wrongfully convicted. People mm-hmm. know it, and they know that they're fabricating evidence, but nobody wants to mm-hmm. walk that back because they're terrified of what it will mean for the mm-hmm. for the army.
To admit that the institution has made an error.
And yes.
not being an expert in the Dreyfus affair, I wonder, in some parts, a little bit of scapegoating with Dreyfus versus, in this case, to not want something very negative to be exposed, to tarnish the profession, which I think is what's really going on with a lot of the folks around My Lai, is just wanting it to not be in the public eye, to not get the attention. And so probably the most damaging thing that occurred for those folks is for Seymour Hersh to grab onto it and not let go.
Yeah.
So
as you looked back on this, and I'm particularly interested in mm-hmm. the perspective of the judge advocates mm-hmm. on this, right? So in that conversation, what was their attitude, and how did this change mm-hmm. how the Army kind of judges itself or polices itself
mm-hmm.
in terms of enforcing the law of armed conflict?
Right. I think, well, in that regard, one of the major improvements or areas we've tried to improve since the Vietnam War is to be more thorough and diligent and hopefully more effective in conveying what the laws of armed conflict are. And so the recognition, and fairly early on, that, yes, we espouse those things. I mean, we told people obey the laws, but how the training occurred and how that was promulgated and reinforced was considered to be fairly weak. So In some regard, the Judge Advocate General Corps is one of the keepers of that flame to help, you know, so the manuals that deal with laws of armed conflict, training that they tend to at least help oversee with the commanders, really commander's responsibility. But also, this is one where, in terms of the exact expansion, there were changes to sort of incorporate Judge Advocate General representatives down to the battalion level, whereas if I understood it in the Vietnam War, that was not the case. So in fact, some of the positions.
What are the benefits of integrating JAGs at a lower level?
Well, I think, and some will say, okay, that there's a negative and a positive. I suppose, when they presented those, the idea of, hey, there are these standards, and to bring them to commanders' attentions, to be there to help deal with ambiguity. Now, my sense is MILA is not that ambiguous.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to ask is, so, your point about we've become more active in teaching people about the law of armed conflict, that seems like it'd be really useful in situations that are highly ambiguous. Mm-hmm. But you're describing, you mentioned three weapons found, mm-hmm. right, in the village, hundreds of people shot down. Seems, and at the time, you have, as you also said, members of the unit who recognize this is wrong, and yet just do this unfolding dynamics of the situation, they can't stop it. You don't need a lesson in the law of armed conflict to know that this is not right.
Right. So there's, and I would say, if we're looking to how to mitigate, a lot of it is about how you prevent something like MILAE from happening again.
Right.
Just having JAG officers is not the answer.
I mean, right.
It's really the preventive area of, there is some education involved, but also there were probably more profound things, the quality of the junior officers and NCOs. We really had lowered standards fairly significantly to get the, in a draft era, to have the draftees, but even the NCOs who were not very well trained, not a lot of training, aside from just law of armed conflict, armed conflict, they had just poor training in basic competency as leaders in the military. And that included the lieutenants, and Callie was, an example of that, very limited training and preparation to be a commissioned officer in the field. So the law of armed conflict is one part of it. So as we're going to professionalize it, but if you're going to say this is a professional standards, well, to have professional standards, you really have to have people capable of behaving like professionals. And some of this is getting well past basic human instincts. We know humans in conflict and violence have certain predispositions. A lot of what a soldier has to do is to be disciplined to do things that we don't expect human beings to do naturally. Basics of staying in a fight rather than fleeing, when we've asked them to put their lives at risk, but also not killing people who are not combatants. I mean, they're obeying the laws. So there's the discipline that goes with it, but that discipline of, okay, how do you know what is appropriate towards non-combatants? That is a critical part of the law of armed conflict.
Well, and this idea of the profession, the military as a profession, it seems like you need to be a little bit careful about how broadly or narrowly you describe the activities of the profession. And if you don't mind, I would like to read something you wrote here in an article you're currently developing, a draft. You said, forces that are focused and prepared for high-end conventional combat against similarly structured and prepared adversaries are often bedeviled by challenges outside that main portfolio. Stability operations, peacekeeping operations, counterinsurgencies, and regular warfare jurisdictions of practice challenge versions of professional expertise that are too narrowly defined. Dispersed forces operating in small groups and among local populations allow adversaries to gain proximity to U.S. forces that can negate powerful standoff engagement advantages and create difficulties in targeting combatants without harming non-combatants. Mm-hmm. And in the story of MILAE, you have this unit that I think is well documented. They've been in country for a few months, they'd suffered casualties, but they'd not really engaged the enemy. Mm-hmm. And there's this profound sense of frustration. So if we're defining the profession as one that's about, find and destroy the enemy. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting you had Lewis Sorley with you because he's written a bit about his book, A Better War, about this kind of reframing of what is the Army supposed to do in Vietnam? Mm-hmm. The whole concept of, what do we do with the population? The whole operation that the unit involved in MILAE was in was sort of punitive in its, and even without the murder part it was sort of punitive in its conception. How do we manage that concept of the profession to enable people to function in a better way in these environments, but at the same time maintain the ability to wage war when it's, you know, more of a high intensity conflict is a tough challenge.
Right. Well, I think, and part of it is in the, you know, the sort of stereotypical sort of conception of conventional combat, you know, large scale units together, you're not too far from other soldiers, you're oriented on enemy forces, and mm-hmm. enemy forces are clearly marked by their uniforms, their equipment, as are the friendly forces. And so the idea that that's, we've tried to simplify it and so that they don't have to make sort of those sort of fine distinctions. We kind of recognize that, you know, we take in a similar sort of circumstance, but from a different premise, you know, what police officers have to do. Assume that they're in a context where there might be somebody who's dangerous, they have weapons and might have to engage somebody who's dangerous, but the presumption that most are not enemies. And sort of flip that sort of how do you get people to respond in these environments? The simple one is to try to simplify it as much as possible for the soldiers to orient them on the enemy and say, that's who you can go after. Now, even with conventional forces, you know, think World War II, there's still plenty of times they were operating around major population centers. And the idea of trying to be careful about engaging non-combatants, but the fact of the matter is, in the midst of combat, whether mainly, you know, put in the context of, you know, in the crossfire, there's no doubt civilian non-combatants suffered grievously, whether particularly air, you know, what we did with bombing and artillery, much less the, you know, the direct fire systems probably were, you know, likely to be a little more careful when you could actually identify them as opposed to some of the more indiscriminate firepower techniques that we would use. So there is that sort of, that's our general model that we've prepared most of the forces for, is that, you know, orient on the uniformed enemy on the other side. But stability operations and counterinsurgencies tend to be more about, in South Vietnam, you know, much like Iraq and Afghanistan, are cases where we were operating in a friendly country. South Vietnam was our ally. The population of South Vietnam were, you know, the people were trying to help their government serve. The enemies, some may have been South Vietnamese, many were, you know, communists coming from the north who were infiltrating and taking advantage of the jungle, the terrain, mountains, and population centers to basically hide themselves. And so trying to get at that enemy. And they were booby trapping and mining areas outside of the population centers, and they were doing things to harass and hurt, kill Americans, and it was frustrating. And frankly, a lot of insurgents over, you know, throughout history usually have started from a weak position, and one of the techniques that tends to serve them well is to get the governing force, which nominally has the legitimacy of leading, to overreact and impose costs on the population. So put aside the fact that, you know, this is not a conversation about relative acts of adversaries in this conflict. I mean, the Vietnamese communists were horrifically more vicious than we are from what we could tell.
But your point is that they're provoking us into overreacting, right. And then that becomes much more strategically significant, mm-hmm. right? I mean, My Lai, in terms of America's position, strategic position in the war became significant.
Yes. And I think that's where, you know, so the idea that it did have an impact, my sense of, like, when we run into these other things, there's a, you know, if you admit that these things happen, or, you know, I think it would be publication of this earlier on and admitting that there was an issue that we were confronting as an aberration, as opposed to trying to hide it, which just made it worse when it did come to light.
Because that just, I mean, you've already done something that's going to damage the public trust. Right. But the higher the level of sort of screw up, the more damage there is to the public trust.
Right. Not to mention the idea that, well, if they're covering up this, what else are they covering
right.
up? And have they been more effective in other cases that we just haven't dug up yet? So it really created, like I said, there's one thing for the event to occur. But the manner in which it was handled is the more institutionally damning thing for the Army profession. In other words, Army leaders who did not act more vigorously to deal with the incident itself and try to mitigate them, similar incidents happening in the future. And again, there's no evidence that there were anything like this that happened after that point in Vietnam. But the idea that, nonetheless, the Army did not take a strong approach to dealing with it quickly.
Yeah. When you graduated from West Point, mm-hmm. I was just thinking about sort of the timing. So your battalion commanders at that time mm-hmm. would have been junior officers mm-hmm. at this time.
Yes.
Did you ever talk to them about their experiences mm-hmm. in the Army at that time and kind of what changed over the course of their careers?
Right. We did actually. One of the things that I witnessed in my first assignment that when I was in the 82nd Airborne Division in the late 80s was that many of the sort of field grade officers above who were Vietnam era veterans, many had been a two or three in Vietnam, they tended not to trust junior non-commissioned officers because of it, particularly from the latter stages. And you can talk to folks who were there throughout the whole war, so a little bit more senior generation, who will note that the Army that started the Vietnam War is probably one of the most professional we ever had. NCOs typically who were World War II and Korean War veterans. Mm-hmm. So somebody with 20 years, 25 years in, you're talking about World War II generation folks, particularly the professionals. But after two or three tours of Vietnam, they retired. If they hadn't, and actually, not a sense that a lot of them were killed, although because a lot of the casualty rates went up later in the war, but that we lost a lot of those professional NCOs, and to get more with the draft army and without a call up of the reserves, a lot of that was done by expedience, sort of short term, promoting people quicker, less education for a lot of the NCOs, so a lower quality of non-commissioned officers. And so one of the things in what witnessed with the officers in the 80s were that had them not trust the NCO Corps. And a lot of the officers were doing things that now we routinely, and it's hard to convey without a little more detailed conversation, what we called NCO business. A lot of this, the officers felt they had to oversee directly because they didn't have that level of trust. And yet by then, the NCO, the non-commissioned officer corps, had recovered pretty well by the mid to late 80s, particularly in a place like the 82nd Airborne Division, which is kind of a double volunteer. You volunteer to be in the Army and you have to volunteer to be on jump status. But nonetheless, that was that lack of trust. And having talked with others, that was a fairly common thing, or more, I won't say how common it was, but there were a lot of officers who had that concern about NCOs, that I think we had to rebuild officers' faith in the NCOs to do leadership at that level.
When you consider the histories of many nations, most nations have episodes in their histories, big ones, in which it seems sort of obvious that they weren't on the side of right, right? So if you imagine being a citizen of just about any country, in America, however, we've always liked to see ourselves as wearing the white hats, in history. And these kinds of episodes, like My Lai, and if you consider obviously some of the Indian campaigns of the late 19th century, they are troubling. Mm-hmm. Research in psychology on cognitive dissonance suggests that not only is it sort of hard to talk about these things, we actually don't want to talk or think about these things because they are dissonant. They don't accord with our view of ourselves or how we identify with ourselves. So what advice would you give the Army, in terms of how to deal with these episodes in the history of the institution so that we sort of pay attention to them, we learn from them, yet we preserve a positive self-image, a positive identity, sort of understanding that we are, generally speaking, a force for good, right? Mm-hmm. To steal from the Navy, global force for good.
Well, I think I first endorsed the idea that, yes, in general, even historically, the United States has been a force for good, and that the military has done a pretty good job of, and again, part of it is, this is more of a relative statement at different points of history. We have sort of set ourselves against standards that were more common in other countries. And I would go back to the Revolution and George Washington. And there's a great book by David Hackett Fisher called Washington's Crossing. And he kind of, at the end of the book, in addition to talking about the American way of war and warfare, he talks about the policy of humanity, the idea that the United States, the Continental Army, Washington, did not reciprocate the sorts of actions that the British Army and some of its forces, the mercenaries from Germany in particular, in the early stages, they committed. And that was a conscious decision. Things like Valley Forge are a choice not to impose upon the local population. That's not, when the soldiers are suffering at Valley Forge, there's not a general suffering going on in Pennsylvania.
They could have taken food from somebody else.
That's right. So the idea of, so partly that's towards the
local
population.
And they're not far from Philadelphia.
That's true. So there's partly the behavior of the soldiers themselves towards the population, as well as towards their adversaries, the the prisoners, the Hessians who were captured, some of which came to Carlisle Barracks, you know, were treated fairly well. And then we've got a long history of that through most of our through our wars. If our prisoners have usually been very surprised at the treatment they received, and oftentimes because they know exactly what would have happened to Americans captured by their forces. The Japanese have brought this up, and in World War II, those after World War II, there's been a lot of examples of this. So, I think there really is a lot of ground to make the case that the American armed forces have been a powerful reflection of American society, and there is a strong moral component about the inherent dignity of anybody's life, and they try to respect that, and so wanton destruction of human beings is not part of our makeup, even in warfare, to try to be as restrained as we can. Doesn't mean we haven't been particularly vicious in our combat, but incidents like this in our wars, like with My Lai, have never, I can't think of any time they've been treated as an honorable act
or typical of U.S. military operations.
They have always been you could think of incidents in the Indian Wars, in the Philippines in the 1890s, early 1900s, in the World Wars, where American soldiers have done things that we've regretted and expressed that those were not, whether criminal or and prosecuted, or even sometimes just use of firepower that maybe was profligate, that in ways that were we later thought might have, were inappropriate. That we've been reflective and self-critical about how do we use force, and so in that regard, taking any of these sorts of incidents that they're likely to happen, warfare is incredibly vicious. It's not an environment you want to put any human beings in the midst of. A professional force is meant to mitigate the worst of those things. One, to meet society's needs, that the only reason force is being used is on behalf of society's greater goods. The title of the podcast is perfect. I mean, for a better state of peace, a better peace, going back to that little heart, phrase. And so having a force that reflects that desire on behalf of society the purpose of war to be a better state of peace, has not just to do with getting to some endpoint, then we'll go back to peace and everything will go back to the way it is. The way you fight a war has a lot to do with the way the war is likely to end, meaning the resistance you induce from your adversaries, and the way the aftermath is likely to be perceived. In other words, what anger, vengefulness, resentment will be there amongst the populations that we do deal with. And so there's a lot of reasons practical as well as moral to make sure the use of force stays connected to what we're trying to accomplish and is consistent with our values. So probably a long way of coming back to anytime these incidents happen, institutionally, the right answer is to, accept them for, take them at face value, but don't try to cover them up. The best, to try to work through and be open. I think that's one of the strengths of our society as a whole, is that we've made lots of mistakes, but we're open to learning. And the Army has been a learning institution similar to the way our society operates. And any of these events, good or bad, are things for us to learn from.
Richard, thank you so much for joining us here on A Better Peace. We appreciate you taking the time to speak with us about this. It's a sobering topic, but an important one.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for the War Room Podcast, and we hope you'll join us next time.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.